During the last day of witnesses in Joseph Hazelwood's pre-trial hearing, defense attorney Rick Friedman worked to fill in any gaps in an enormous pyramid of evidence. The pinnacle is Hazelwood's report to the Coast Guard. Along the base are 11 boxes representing the state's allegations. An intricate web of color-coded lines and boxes with actions and evidence connects the base with three boxes just below the top of the triangle. As of 3:35 a.m. on March 24th, the investigative leads consisted of attempts to get off the reef, the smell of alcohol detected by a Coast Guard investigator, and a statement of a problem with the third mate. Defense Attorney Friedman says all further evidence stemmed from those three, only possible with Hazelwood's report of spilled oil, and Hazelwood should be immune from prosecution. The state contends the spill would have been discovered anyway, and all evidence collected after at least March 24th should be admissible in criminal proceedings against Hazelwood. Wednesday's testimony focused on how the criminal division of the State Department of Law worked in this case, as it became aware of the immunity issue that could be raised and could prevent Hazelwood's prosecution. Chief of Criminal Prosecution for the state, Larry Weeks, testified he was involved in making some of the decisions about the case, especially when it came to the question of whether or not to indict third mate Gregory Cousins. The prosecutors investigating the case that had been shielded from evidence collected on the 24th wanted to indict Cousins. Weeks told defense attorney Friedman he consulted with Attorney General Doug Bailey before giving them the decision.
They wanted to do it, and basically I told them no.
And did you give them any reasons?
I did. I gave them several.
Can you tell us what those were?
Well, I think most of all what I said was I felt like that if we were going to be prosecuting other people, that I wanted to go up the chain and not down the chain. If there was someone other than Joe Hazelwood that the state was going to prosecute, I wanted that to be an Exxon entity or a facsimile or someone in that organization.
As Friedman questioned further, Weeks said that at the time, Exxon, Alyeska, and federal attorneys had been informed that the state wouldn't be bringing charges against either Alyeska or Exxon. But Brent Cole and Marianne Henry wanted very much to indict Cousins, and they told Weeks why.
They felt like that he had been the actual control of the ship and that he had time to do something differently and didn't do it, and that Brent in particular had been on the ship and had looked at the instruments, and he felt like that Mr. Cousins should have been able to see that something was coming up and didn't do it.
Weeks still vetoed their decision. Cousins was not indicted. Larry Weeks saw himself as Assistant District Attorney Bob Linton's supervisor in the case. Linton was given the job of screening all information that would go to Cole and Henry, the prosecutors untainted with information from March 24th. But Weeks kept his hand in the action. Cole and Henry wanted screened information from the National Transportation Safety Board hearings. Friedman questioned Weeks about his role in the investigation again, and Weeks appeared exasperated.
What I see myself is more in most of the conversations that were going on. I guess I see myself more as a sounding board and somebody who talks about things and makes decisions. They tell me what they want and why they want it and how bad they need it, and I sometimes say there are not resources out there. I do those things. Occasionally I say no. I think in this situation, I mean, I believe that I always have the ability to veto, and I believe that I exercise that in two instances in this investigation.
Cousins
and NTSB.
Okay.
I mean, if they had had their way, they would have had NTSB. At least for the nonce, I was saying no to that.
The day ended with prosecutor Bob Linton himself on the stand, questioned by still another district attorney, Bob Stockler. Linton was the one person who knew all the evidence, admittedly truly tainted with information. He admitted that many people were interviewed by state investigators before the separate, clean prosecuting team was formed, and he detailed the incredibly meticulous methods he used to ensure they didn't become tainted. Judge Carl Johnstone has asked both sides to return to court on Monday, oral arguments ready. He said he may be ready then to rule on the immunity issue. For APRN in Anchorage, I'm Sue Burris.
That was probably a cautious estimate of a time when the activities of people in that town or the surrounding areas would have uncovered the existence of the ship and the oil, and would have been reacting to it in them of themselves, even had there been no initial report. I said to myself, is this all this activity a response to a report, or is it a response to the existence of a ship on a rock leaking a lot of oil? And the question was, it seemed to me that at some point the response was to a ship on a rock leaking oil and not to simply a report made by a person.
Hazelwood's defense attorney, Rick Friedman, says exculpatory evidence, evidence that might have cleared his client, Joseph Hazelwood, from wrongdoing, was not given to the grand jury. And that was one of the questions Friedman explored when prosecutor Bob Linton took the witness stand on Wednesday as the last witness in the pretrial hearing that will determine if Hazelwood will have a trial at all. Friedman took Linton through pages of notes, asking for clarification. An entry dated April 19th seemed to indicate that the state's chief of criminal prosecution was controlling which evidence prosecutors would know about. If the prosecutors didn't know about them, the grand jury wouldn't have the opportunity to consider evidence in FBI reports called 302s. Linton read from his notes.
4:30 p.m., telephone 2 weeks. Don't get 302s. Number one, if exculpatory, we would have to put, and I don't know what, and then it just trailed, nothing else is written. Number two, would be discoverable, and feds do not understand that.
Then, does if exculpatory, we would have to put, refer to putting them on in grand jury?
Linton read and reread his notes very carefully.
I think that's the only interpretation I can put on. I can't make any other meaning from the context.
The phone call was between Linton and Larry Weeks, chief of criminal prosecution for the state. As Linton recalled the conversation, it was Weeks who didn't want the grand jury to have access to the FBI reports. Linton was the person screening all the information the state's prosecutors were able to consider as they prepared their case for the grand jury. Linton said there was some evidence that was withheld simply because he didn't think it was exculpatory. Next week, Judge Carl Johnstone will rule on whether the indictments against Joseph Hazelwood should be dismissed, and if not, what evidence can be used in his trial. In Anchorage, I'm Sue Burris. When Joseph Hazelwood radioed the Coast Guard last March 24th and said his ship, the Exxon Valdez, was hard aground and leaking some oil, prosecutor Bob Linton says he actually made two reports. One was a report of marine casualty, the ship aground. The other was a report of spilled oil. Linton argued that the law protecting Hazelwood from prosecution because he reported the spill does not apply to any evidence collected because he reported the ship aground. He said that the report of the grounding alone was an independent source and would have been enough to begin the Coast Guard's investigation.
The independent source theory is founded upon the testimony of three people of the Coast Guard, Commander McCall, Commander Falkenstein, and CWO Delosier, that this was the kind of thing that they would have responded to just on the basis of the report of a grounding. But what is equally important is that it bears upon a subsequent or a second type of inevitable discovery. That is, that the Coast Guard would have discovered it themselves via radar and would have responded to it.
Not only would the Coast Guard's radar have shown problems with the Exxon Valdez, Linton argued, the Chevron California was also headed toward Valdez early that Good Friday morning and would have reported both the vessel aground and the ship leaking oil. Considering all the possible what-ifs, Linton outlined the sequence of events that led him to designate just after 6 o'clock in the morning as the time the vessel would have been inevitably discovered and investigators would have been on board.
We say that the things that flowed after that, the observations that flowed after that, would have otherwise flowed, and And so that the real focus here is on what things would not have been discovered in that time frame. What things would not have been observed.
The only things Linton says wouldn't have been observed were the reports of alcohol on Captain Hazelwood's breath by Coast Guard and Department of Environmental Conservation investigators. But defense attorney Rick Friedman says it is precisely those observations stemming from Hazelwood's own report which led to much of the testimony that indicted Hazelwood. Both sides agreed that there are few, if any, precedents for the decisions that Judge Carl Johnstone must make in the case, and Friedman cautioned the judge.
I would submit that the prosecutors are on thin ice and he's asking the court to join him out there.
Friedman argued that the laws governing reporting of oil spills are very specific.
Congress said, we want you to report oil spills, whatever the circumstances. And in return, we're willing to give you immunity. We want you to report so badly we're going to make it a crime not to report. And in return, we're going to give you immunity.
The state's investigation went on for 3 weeks, Friedman said, before the prosecution began to separate the evidence that would not be presented to the grand jury because of the immunity question. And Friedman noted that the state may have made its accusations prematurely.
By charging Captain Hazelwood before they even figured out the extent of his immunity, the state painted itself into a corner. What are they going to do now? Say, oops, we made a mistake? In front of the entire nation and say, it turns out you've got immunity and we overlooked this statute and so we're going to withdraw the prosecution. At that point, they'd gotten out on thin ice and there was no way for them to get back.
Judge Carl Johnstone hopes to make an announcement on Hazelwood's immunity from prosecution Tuesday. As he told the court, a lot depends on this decision. For APRN in Anchorage, I'm Sue Burris.
While the oil industry scrambles to repair its safety image in the wake of the Exxon Valdez oil spill, the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company is forging ahead with an expensive program to deal with another critical problem. Corrosion's been eating at parts of the 800-mile pipeline ever since the metal pipe was first delivered to Fairbanks 20 years ago. Alyeska says several miles of pipe need to be replaced, an operation that could cost hundreds of millions of dollars. Critics say the damage is partly the result of poor planning and bad management decisions by Alyeska. In this first of a series of reports, Peter Kenyon looks at what went wrong.
Pattingen Pass is a place of stunning beauty about 100 miles north of the Arctic Circle. The Attigan River slips through jagged mountain peaks on this crackling clear October afternoon. This is the peak of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, some 4,700 feet above sea level. Tall sheep dot the mountainside, and fat ravens stand out against the snowy backdrop. But the men and women who work here aren't stopping to admire the natural beauty of Alaska's Brooks Range. These Alyeska Pipeline Service Company workers are welding a sleeve, a new section of pipe that will be welded over an old, corroded piece of the 48-inch diameter line. Lee Schoen is one of Alyeska's project managers for the corrosion project. Small pitted area on the pipe. The rusted, damaged metal has already been sandblasted off. And that even this insignificant-looking flaw in the pipe is dangerous enough to need repair.
Yes, there's enough to warrant a sleeve for the pressure. And these are measured with very accurate micrometers as well as with the ultrasonic detection devices. Sometimes a couple thousandths or a couple hundredths of an inch makes the difference.
This operation is part of Alyeska's program to find and stop the corrosion that's been eating away at spots on the line for over a decade. By the beginning of this year, Alyeska had identified over 800 anomalies, what they call potential rust spots on the pipeline. The pipeline carries 1.9 million barrels of North Slope crude oil to Valdez every day. Alyeska, the consortium that operates the pipeline for the North Slope oil producers, says so far no oil has leaked from the main line because of corrosion. By the time Alyeska installs an entirely new 8.5-mile stretch of pipe where the worst corrosion is, here at Attigan Pass, The company estimates it may have spent up to $200 million. And a growing number of critics are saying this expensive repair program may not have been necessary. The pipeline company denies that, but official documents and interviews with Alyeska workers, state officials, and industry experts reveal a number of problems with Alyeska's original corrosion protection program, including the following highlights. Alyeska left the bare metal pipe exposed to the elements for over a year. The company then had the already corroded pipe covered with a defective epoxy coating, one that was so bad Alyeska sued the manufacturer for breach of contract. Then, over the objections of its own experts in the field, Alyeska wrapped the pipe with a flawed tape product. And instead of reporting it to government officials, one oil company executive recommended destroying all evidence that Alyeska knew of the problem. And when Alyeska finally got the right tape, it wasn't applied properly in some areas, and that's where the corrosion is. To get a sense of what went wrong here, you have to know a little bit about how corrosion happens. First of all, it mainly happens underground, and nearly half the Trans-Alaska pipeline is buried. Engineers say when you take iron ore out of the ground and refine it into metal pipe, you're adding energy to it. And when you put it back in the ground, the natural tendency is to release that energy. Left to its own devices, the metal will discharge a small current of electricity into the soil, carrying with it particles of metal. And corrosion engineer Kevin Garrity says while that current is small, it doesn't take long to do major damage to the pipe. Garrity is vice president for engineering at the Core Test Company in Ohio. He says the metal removing power of this current is phenomenal.
For example, if we had 1 amp of direct current leaving an underground pipeline, in 1 year's time, we will have lost 20 pounds of that underground pipeline.
And even tiny holes in the Trans-Alaska pipeline can release a lot of oil. The pipeline may be 800 miles long, but it's only half an inch thick. That's half an inch between a working pipeline and an oil-soaked tundra. And the pipeline carries hot crude oil at extremely high pressures, in some areas as high as 900 pounds per square inch or more. In 1979, a crack in the line, not caused by corrosion, only 5 inches long and 1/16 of an inch wide, spewed an estimated 63,000 gallons of crude onto the tundra. One way to protect the line from corrosion is to create a kind of short circuit by isolating the metal from the soil. And because no protective coating works perfectly, a backup system is often used, known as cathodic protection. Boat owners practice cathodic protection when they install zinc plates on their vessels. Zinc will corrode before other metals, sacrificing itself to protect the boat. So Alyeska laid ribbons of zinc along the underground pipe. In theory, these protections should have kept the pipeline free from rust. But in close to 100 places identified so far, those systems failed to stop the corrosion. And critics say those failures are in part the result of poor planning and management by Alyeska and the owner companies when the line was constructed. One problem was that the pipe was ordered and shipped to Fairbanks in 1969, and then sat around exposed to the elements until 1975, while opponents of the pipeline battled the project in court and in Congress. Another problem was that the pipe was shipped unprotected over the ocean. Scientists now believe that even small amounts of salt can lead to corrosion and undermine protective coatings. According to a report based on Alyeska's own monthly construction updates, the company discovered corrosion on the pipe in 1970 and ordered the pipe coated with an epoxy resin known as Scotchcoat 202 made by the 3M company. That process took nearly 2 years, and as Alyeska engineer Bill Howitt recalls, it was a mistake.
It had two problems. First, it was disbonding from the pipe, so that means that water or other impurities could get under it and cause corrosion. Second, while it was supposed to be able to take the bending, when you bend a pipe in a bending mandrel, it was really marginal on that and it flaked off. So we had disbonding and flaking of it, so we really had to do something else.
One thing Alyeska did was sue 3M and the Texas company that applied the coating. In a complaint filed in Anchorage Superior Court in 1975, Alyeska alleged that the product was defective. The defendants replied that the pipe was already in such a rusted, pitted condition when they coated it that the failure of the coating wasn't their fault. The case was eventually settled out of court with a confidential cash payment from 3M to Alyeska. A protective coating that doesn't coat properly presents a serious corrosion threat. because the backup system of cathodic protection is only marginally effective with a flawed coating. Corrosion engineer Kevin Garrity.
We get an undercutting effect, and if the coating does disbond from that, it's extremely difficult at that point to achieve cathodic protection. We've got to have a very well-bonded coating for the two systems to complement each other.
So the decision was made some 2.5 years after Scotchcoat was found to be flawed to tape the pipe. And here again, Alyeska chose the wrong product and then had problems applying the right product when it finally arrived. These criticisms are contained in a report by Terry Lenzner. He's a former Watergate attorney who was retained as special counsel by the state in 1977. His task was to scrutinize the $9 billion price tag the owners had placed on the line. The Lenzner report concluded that $1.5 billion of those costs resulted from mismanagement and lack of planning. Reached at his Washington, D.C. office, Lenzner recalls that the coating and taping problems were part of a pattern of poor management in which Alyeska not only made the wrong moves, but did so over the objections of its own experts in the field, known as the execution contractors.
Alyeska and the owners made decisions that were completely inconsistent with the recommendations that the execution contractors came to. In this case, they recommended that the Alyeska not use something called the green line tape, and despite those recommendations by the execution contractors, Alyeska went ahead and used it anyway.
Lenzner also discovered that at least one owner company was primarily concerned with hiding the fact that Alyeska knew about these problems. The report quotes from a memo obtained only after a court battle. It was from ARCO Vice President Lloyd Foy to Alyeska Project Manager Frank Moulin. According to the Lenzner report, the memo listed the problems with the green line tape and advised that, quote, it might be well to destroy this report so there will be nothing in your files that indicates any expected trouble with Royston green line tape. Alyeska's Bill Howard says only about 40 to 50 miles of the pipeline is wrapped in the green line tape, which in his words was less than satisfactory under high temperature conditions. Howitt calls Foy's memo a personal comment and not reflective of ARCO's policy or Alyeska's. The Lenzner report said that memo reflected a duplicitous attitude, recommending that information bearing on the integrity of the pipeline be destroyed. Finally, by the fall of 1975, Alyeska installed yet another protective wrap known as Raychem Articlad II tape. In addition to causing delays and further expenses while a whole new set of taping equipment and procedures was put in place, the new tape didn't always fit properly. Again, citing internal Alyeska memos, Lenzner reported that the remains of the old Scotchcoat coating left blisters in the new tape, undermining its effectiveness. And when Alyeska crews started digging up the pipeline here at Attigan Pass, they found that the tape simply hadn't been put on properly. Ron Dalby is Alyeska's manager for pump stations 3 and 4.
Many times it looks like they had a problem during construction with the taping machine and did not get an adequate taping job for a few feet, and then water got under it and corroded the pipe.
It twists or a space is there?
Right. The taping machine had a series of wheels that wrapped the pipe, and maybe once in a while the wheels would jam up or something, and a few places down here, it looked like one of the wheels stuck and drug along the bottom of the pipe and had the tape crinkled up, and that was exactly where the corrosion was.
Alyeska plans to run a complete new 8.5-mile stretch of the pipeline here at a cost that could come in anywhere from $100 to $200 million. The company is also investigating hundreds of other potential corrosion points along the line. Alyeska is proud of its recent corrosion control program, and it predicts this bypass operation will include the latest anti-corrosion materials and a textbook quality control program. Alyeska's Bill Howitt says last time they were rushing to beat the coming winter and the approaching deadline for the pipeline. This time, he says, they'll get it right. For the state of Alaska, which once helped the oil industry build this pipeline across untouched Arctic wilderness, and now feels betrayed by the industry after the nation's worst oil spill, Alyeska's word may not be enough. For the Alaska Public Radio Network, I'm Peter Kennedy.
This week, the Alaska Public Radio Network is examining the problems of corrosion in the Trans-Alaska pipeline system. Yesterday, we heard about corrosion slipping through two layers of defenses to eat away at buried sections of the pipeline. Today, Peter Kenyon reports on a different kind of corrosion, one that's attacking the pipe from the inside.
Earlier this month, at the Valdez Terminal, Alyeska workers were opening up a section of pipe at the vapor recovery system when they got a surprise. What they found was a pipe heavily clogged with oil-soaked corrosion debris from other parts of the system. The pipe carries an inert gas that is small amounts of sulfur dioxide and other elements that in large quantities make up acid rain. The corrosive power of those elements is enhanced by moisture, so Alyeska was opening the pipe to install a dehydrator. Calls to Alyeska for more information on the incident were referred to the manager of the engineering department, Bill Howitt. In addition to being the company spokesperson on the external corrosion problem, Howitt supervised the marine terminal for several years. In a telephone interview last week, Howitt said Alyeska knew these pipes would corrode. In an effort to save money, the company decided not to build the system with stainless steel. Instead, it used plain carbon steel, knowing it would have to be replaced at some point. Howitt said this pipe was partially clogged and creating a dangerous situation. He said some of the oil-soaked rust particles are highly flammable, making it difficult, in his words, to create a safe atmosphere for welding. In response to comments that some of the pipe in this area was so corroded you could put your finger through it, Howitt said that was possible.
Well, certainly, the point just before something perforates is a spot where you can put your finger through it, right? There's a point just before that anything corrodes right on through, just like the side of a car. I don't know at the time you're talking about there was, but I can tell you that in the past there has been that. And that in itself is not necessarily a problem either.
It's not a problem, says Howitt, because unlike the main line, the pressure here is extremely low, almost nil. In fact, because the system operates at a slight vacuum, the big danger is not something leaking out, but oxygen leaking in, which could set up an explosive situation that requires an intricate alarm system to protect against. About 150 miles south of Prudhoe Bay, nearly 2 million barrels of North Slope crude cross the Brooks Range each day. The hot oil cruises at about 7 miles an hour over Attigan Pass. Normally in the northern Brooks Range at this time of year, you might hear the occasional bird or animal cry. But for the past dozen years, America's hunger for Alaskan oil has introduced a new sound to this isolated spot, one that puts even the relentless Arctic wind to shame. Welcome to Pump Station 4. These high-powered pumps are taking crude that wanders in at about 100 pounds of pressure and whipping it up to nearly 1,000 pounds per square inch for its journey over Attigan Pass. At some of the pump stations along the 800-mile pipeline, there are dead-end lines known as dead legs. These dead legs are vulnerable to internal corrosion from products in the water that separate out from the North Slope crude during its journey down the line. When the salt or bacteria in the water settles into the bottom of a piece of pipe, it eats away at it. This spring, a small amount of oily water leaked from a dead leg at one of the pump stations. If external corrosion is basically an electrical leakage of bits of metal into the soil, internal corrosion is more like an acidic chemical process. In fields that produce so-called sweet crude, the main corrosive element is carbon dioxide. North Slope oil is a mildly sour crude, and the dangerous element there is hydrogen sulfide, or H2S. And corrosion expert John Beavers, an engineer for the Cortez Company in Columbus, Ohio, says H2S poses a much more serious corrosion threat.
It, in some cases, will accelerate general corrosion or pitting corrosion, which actually have localized areas of corrosion. But by far the biggest problem with the hydrogen sulfide is that it can induce cracking failures of the pipelines.
Hydrogen cracking is a relatively new discovery among corrosion experts, and it's been blamed for failures in a number of metal structures, especially airplane landing gear and other high-strength steels. Most oil pipelines are not as vulnerable to this particular kind of cracking, known as brittle failure, and Prudhoe Bay is not as sulfurous as some other fields. But H2S can still pose a problem. Beaver says over time, small amounts of hydrogen actually permeate the metal, usually at spots that were flawed to begin with. Depending on the circumstances, it may take years for enough hydrogen to build up in the metal to cause fractures. Alyeska spokesperson George Jerkowicz says the company does use an ultrasonic device called a shear wave that's especially useful at seeking out fractures. So far, according to Jerkowicz, few cracks have been found. But that may change. The state director of environmental quality, Larry Dietrich, says sulfur corrosion problems could get worse as the Prudhoe Bay field gets older.
That's basically what's going on here is H2S concentration increases, the potential for corrosion would also increase. And generally, this has been a low sulfur crude historically, and those levels will slowly increase as time goes on here as the field matures.
Another internal problem that could increase with age is erosion. This usually occurs when sand or grit pumped up with the oil starts to wear away the inside of the pipe. ARCO crews on the North Slope are just about finished cleaning up roughly 200 barrels that spilled from an eroded line last week. Corrosion engineer Beaver says hydrogen-related cracks are still hard to detect. Even using the latest high-tech devices, ultrasonic detectors known in the industry as smart pigs, companies are in the experimental stages when it comes to finding cracks.
You're really pushing, this is sort of the forefront of technology right now, are these, they call them smart pigs, to try to detect cracking-related phenomena. They're much better at detecting gross wall thinning due to corrosion or large pitted areas.
Beaver speculates that these high-tech rust detectives will prove useful at spotting cracks. The next report in this series will examine the latest technology for dealing with corrosion. For the Alaska Public Radio Network, I'm Peter Kenyon.
As part of its program to repair rusted sections of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company is reviewing the latest anti-corrosion technology and hardware. In this third report in a series on pipeline rust, Peter Kenyon looks at what's out there and what Alyeska may decide to use.
At most of the 12 pump stations along the Alaska Pipeline, crude oil simply gets pumped up to maximum pressure to help move it along its 800-mile journey to Valdez. But here at Pump Station 4 near Adigan Pass, there's a series of valves and bypass lines that makes it appear as if there's a break in the line.
You can kind of get where you want to get. This is going to hold it back out from here.
This is a receiving and launching room. A group of reporters and photographers are gathered for a demonstration of a ritual known as a pig launching. Even the Alyeska workers aren't exactly sure why they're called pigs. They certainly don't resemble any farmyard animal. They look more like giant rib bullets. One story has it that you can hear them squeal as they go down the pipeline. Pigs are industry slang for internal detection and cleaning devices that are launched down the pipeline to either scrape the insides of the pipe, check for bends or buckles in the line, or, more recently and most critically, to measure the thickness of the pipe. Alyeska engineer Bill Howitt points to the receiver, a capped end of the main line that opens to disgorge the crude-covered pig while the oil flow is diverted around the launch room. Pump Station 4 is the first stop for the machines after being loaded at Prudhoe Bay.
When it comes out here, we unload the data here and put in fresh tape, if it's a tape recording type of a pig, and then launch it again.
As the crew gets ready to open the launcher, powerful fans switch on to suck out the noxious crude oil fumes that waft out of the line. The workers are wearing respirators, and cameras and tape recorders are shut off to avoid even the remote possibility of a spark in this volatile atmosphere. A long tray slides out of the pipe, and the pig is hoisted onto it and slides back into the launcher. From there, the pig can enter the main line as the oil is diverted back behind it to push it down the line. The older pigs used magnetic fields to measure the pipe walls. Now, ultrasonic pigs are the corrosion detector of choice. The newer pigs are sensitive to metal loss as low as 10% of the half-inch pipe. The older models didn't register any corrosion until half the pipe thickness was gone. So far, these pigs have identified over 800 potential corrosion points on the 800-mile pipeline. Critics say the reasons for some of the corrosion on the line, including poor coatings and misapplied tapes, should make it obvious where the line is most vulnerable. But it was only with the recent advances in these magnetic and ultrasonic pigs that the true extent of the corrosion problem began to emerge. And Ohio-based corrosion engineer John Beavers says in some areas, even these devices have only what he calls weatherman success. They detect thousands of potential flaws instead of the much smaller number of actual problem areas. Now that Alyeska is getting better at identifying stretches of pipe that need to be replaced, the next question is what to replace them with. The first line of defense against corrosion is a protective coating. Alyeska's Howitt says a whole range of new products and procedures are under study, with an eye toward giving this new 8.5-mile stretch of pipe at Attigan Pass the best rust protection today's technology can provide.
Tremendous advances have been made in pipeline coatings in the 15 years since we originally built the pipeline. These include things like extruded polyethylene and extruded polypropylene, and some major advances have also been made in fusion-bonded epoxies. And we're quite confident that we'll be able to come up with a product that's quite superior to what we've been using.
The original coating on the pipeline was a fusion-bonded epoxy that developed severe corrosion problems. But corrosion engineer Kevin Garrity says today's improved epoxy coatings are among the best products around. And he says the industry also has a better understanding of how important the surface preparation of the pipe is. In addition, Garrity says there have been strides made in the second line of defense, cathodic protection.
Cathodic protection systems that were originally used on the Alyeska line were primarily, as I recall, zinc anodes. Today we have better materials. We have polymer carbon materials that can be plowed in adjacent to the line, and we're getting exceptionally good performance with them.
Alyeska probably won't be using this new method on the main line because it would require a major overhaul. Company spokesperson George Jerkowicz says Alyeska will be switching from zinc to magnesium, which should be an improvement over the old system. Beyond the anti-rust products themselves, engineers agree that regular, almost incessant monitoring is essential to full protection. At this stage of detector pig technology, so many potential flaws are being identified that a major re-inspection of those areas is needed. Alyeska still hasn't checked all the possible flaws found so far. Alyeska downplays the disastrous possibility that all this is designed to prevent, a major spill on the tundra. After the Exxon Valdez, that would be the last thing the Alaska oil industry needs. And Howitt admits the company has been taking a closer look at its ability to deal with a land-based spill. But the company is still predicting that the most likely accident would be a small one.
We're pretty confident that we'll be able to catch anything before that would even become a problem, but we have been reviewing our contingency plans very carefully, especially in this area, and if there was something like that, it wouldn't be, to the best of our estimates, a catastrophic type of event. It would be a seep or a pinhole leak of that and that sort of thing, so it would be something we could control.
For the Alaska Public Radio Network, I'm Peter Kenyon.
Like almost everything associated with the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, the price tag for finding and fixing rust on the line is big. Alyeska Pipeline Service Company expects to spend as much as $200 million buying and installing several miles of pipeline to replace a segment that's corroded beyond repair. In the final installment of our series on pipeline corrosion, Peter Kenyon reports that state officials are happy to see the line being repaired, but not so happy to learn that the state will be picking up a big chunk of the bill.
When State Revenue Commissioner Hugh Malone briefed reporters recently on the latest revenue projections, he had some grim news to deliver. The short-term projection may be up, but three items will sharply cut into future revenues: lower oil production, the Valdez oil spill, and corrosion on the pipeline. The decline in production had been expected. But the prospect of the state paying a portion of the industry's bills for increased oil spill response and corrosion control is causing concern. State officials are questioning whether the state should be paying more for oil spill safety that Alyeska claimed to have been providing all along. And similar questions are being raised about the corrosion costs. Hugh Malone.
In my mind, they're sort of linked. They both appear to represent costs that have been deferred.
Alyeska's manager of engineering rejects any suggestion that the company deferred action on the corrosion problem to save money. Bill Howitt says Alyeska and the owner companies demand a timely, cost-efficient maintenance program.
I don't agree with an assertion like that at all. Our business is, in Alyeska, is to ship all the oil, to carry all the oil from Prudhoe Bay to Valdez, which is nominated by the shippers to the carriers. And that is our prime. And we need to keep the pipeline in very good condition to be able to do that.
Malone is in a fairly tough spot here. As the state's top revenue official, he would have to object to paying for Alyeska's mistakes. On the other hand, the state has just as much interest in protecting the pipeline as the oil industry does. If it's a question of preventing leaks in the line, Malone says the money is secondary. In fact, he wants the state to examine Alyeska's original source data on the corrosion problem. He says the state should satisfy itself as to how serious the problem is and how long Alyeska has known about it.
I think that we can't take Alyeska's word for it. We've tried that before. We can't afford another disaster like the Exxon Valdez.
Once the state is sure everything possible is being done to protect the pipeline, Malone says the state has to start looking out for its revenue interests. The way the companies may shift some of their costs to the state is through the TAPS transportation tariff. Everybody who ships oil through the pipeline pays a fee for using the line. That's basically the oil companies and the state, which owns a 1/8 royalty share of the crude. The companies also deduct the transportation charge from their tax payments to the state. Now, for the larger oil companies, paying the tariff simply means one branch of the company pays another branch. But when the state ships its oil through the line, that's pure profit for the pipeline owners, carved out of the state's income. The general rule of thumb state officials use is that the tariff allows the oil industry to shift about 25% of the burden to the state, through both royalty and tax deductions. The tariff goes up when the pipeline owners spend money to keep the line in working order, because they're entitled to get their legitimate operating costs back. The question for the state is whether all these corrosion expenses are legitimate. If not, the state may not have to pay them. Evidence compiled by state-hired investigators in 1977 documented the lack of planning and mismanagement that went into the construction of the pipeline. And part of that evidence involves the anti-corrosion coating and taping of the underground pipe. If the costs of fixing corroded pipe now can be linked to those mistakes, and in some cases they have by Alyeska's own workers and documents, the state may have reason to challenge the new TAPS tariff charges to be filed December 1st. Two of the people who examined the cost overruns 12 years ago agree that the state should consider challenging the tariffs. Dr. Robert Lind is a professor of economics at Cornell University. In his analysis of the peculiar economics of the pipeline, he noted that it's in the interest of the companies to make the tariff as high as possible. This will minimize the amount that the owner companies will have to pay in royalties and taxes to the state, and will maximize the amount of the cost of the pipeline which they can shift from themselves to the state and its taxpayers. Reached in New York, Lynn said the state should protect its right to question these tariff filings.
I think it is absolutely clear in regulatory practice that as a user of the pipeline and the payer of the tariff, they have a right to review what Alyeska has done in terms of their procedures. And if they're found wanting, then I think there is a precedent for saying, look, we shouldn't pay for all of that because some of that was the result of bad management.
Washington attorney Terry Lenzner holds a similar view. Lenzner was the special counsel who led the probe of the cost overruns on the pipeline. He says the history of the pipeline suggests that close scrutiny of the new tariffs is in order.
The evidence that we accumulated suggested that, in fact, there was an incentive to build the pipeline as quickly as possible because the costs were going to be, to some extent, reimbursed through the adding it into the tariff anyway. So our task for the Alaska Pipeline Commission was to determine whether substantial costs had been incurred that were imprudent, that an ordinary construction project wouldn't have, or a construction manager would not have done what they did in that particular circumstance, and certainly the taping system was a good example of that.
Lenzner reported that millions of dollars was spent on a faulty coating for the pipe. He also found that Alyeska overrode its own experts in the field and ordered a taping system that also proved defective in some conditions. And Alyeska workers say that when the right tape finally arrived, in some areas it wasn't applied properly. In Lenzner's view, it added up to tens of millions of dollars that should not be recoverable through the tariff. Alaska's Attorney General Doug Bailey says the state has been looking into the tariff issue since it was notified of the coming increase. He says he's not satisfied with the information coming from Alyeska so far, but the state intends to evaluate the propriety of these charges.
We're aware of the problem, and we have initiated plans that we think will allow us to at least formulate an initial impression or initial conclusion as to whether those costs are appropriate or whether they may result in, at least in part from from mismanagement or wrongfully deferred past maintenance or something of that sort.
The new tariffs will officially be filed in 2 weeks. For the Alaska Public Radio Network, I'm Peter Kenyon.